I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I am talking to Sherry Berman, professor of political science at Barnard College, Columbia University. We're discussing her 2019 book, Democracy and Dictatorship, From the Ancien Regime to the Present Day, from Oxford University Press. Berman works on European history and politics, political development, democratization and consolidation, populism, fascism, and the history of the left. She is the author of The Primacy of Politics, Social Democracy and the Making of Europe's 20th Century, and The Social Democratic Moment, as well as many articles. First of all, let me say, Sherry Berman, thank you so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Sherry, this great book, thank you for writing it. It's a really sweeping account of the development of liberal democracy in Europe, along with the many, many obstacles and setbacks that democracy faces over the many years since the Ancien Regime. And it offers a lot of helpful lessons, I think, for today, which all of which we'll talk about. Let me start, which is to ask you what motivated you writing the book. And one way the motivation is on the surface, in the same way that I had Bill Galston on a couple times ago speaking about the problems of resurgent populism, the challenges to liberal democracy, and your book is in part motivated by that. But, so maybe you could say a little bit, you know, sort of what motivated you in this direction? Why did you take up this approach to the problem?
Sure. There were two motivations, which spring from sort of both halves of my professional career. So one motivation sprang from my teaching. I started about 10 years ago teaching a large lecture course at Barnard and Columbia with the same title as this book, Democracy and Dictatorship in Europe. And it was designed as an intro course for students to give them a sense both of what European political development looked like and what comparative politics was. So I started teaching this course, and it originated as a sort of series of lectures on kind of the greatest hits of European political development. You know, there were some lectures on the French Revolution, some lectures on 1848, German and Italian unification, lots of lectures on the interwar period, on the post-war period, yada, yada, yada. But the class sort of didn't hang together, I realized, after teaching it for a couple of years, but rather was kind of, you know, a series of lectures, as I mentioned, on sort of the most important events in European political development. And part of the reason for this was that while there was a huge amount, obviously, of political science literature on why democracies and dictatorships develop, there wasn't much political science literature applying those theories to historical cases, because political scientists are not very historically minded, and there's been a large shift away from even regional knowledge over the past generation. Now, there were an unbelievable number of books by historians on any of these particular time periods, but those books tended to be neither comparative — historians study particular countries in particular times — nor were they theoretical. So the course was, you know, sort of, I thought, good, but it kind of lacked a sort of overall linking narrative, which, as I began sort of thinking more about it, both became a little bit clearer in my mind, because I had been teaching it already, as I said, for a couple of years. And also I thought, well, look, you know, there really should be a book that kind of brings these cases together in a comparative and a theoretical way. So part of the motivation for the book was simply my own recognition of what I thought were some lacunae in both the historical and the political science literature, the historians being less comparative and theoretical, and the political scientists not being as attuned to historical cases in general or rich analytical narratives rather than superficial and sketchy ones as well. But the other motivation comes from my research, which is that I'm a scholar not just of European politics, but of political development. And I care very deeply about why democracies develop, why they succeed in some places and sometimes and not others. And I didn't think, actually, that a lot of our discussion today did a very good job of thinking about how what we were experiencing today with the sort of, you know, third wave and the third wave undertow, how that actually compared to previous waves or experiences with democracy. The conversation was very rich in some ways, and there was, of course, as always, a lot of great political scientists writing treatments of what was going on, but they seemed, again, to kind of lack historical perspective, and it was therefore, I thought, relatively difficult to tell, for example, if a lot of the problems countries were experiencing today were unique to either this period or those countries, or they were sort of more general manifestations of problems with, again, overcoming the legacies of dictatorships and building democracies. So the second motivation in this kind of long-winded explanation was to kind of add what I thought was a broader historical perspective to conversations we were having about what was going on with democracy today.
Yeah, that's good. I was going to ask you, and you sort of alluded to this a little bit, but sort of situating your approach and the field of comparative political development broadly into political science in general, because I'm a political theorist. I know a lot of people who listen to this show are political theorists, so we're sort of familiar with political theory and with some political science, although mostly, as you say, political science has moved more in a dominant quantitative approach, which is less historical. Some of us may know sort of American political development people like Stephen Skowronek or Sid Milkus. I mean, are people like Theda Skocpol and Francis Fukuyama? These are sort of some of the major figures in the field. Maybe you just say a little bit about the field to sort of orient us.
Sure. So, I mean, those are both great figures to point out, not only because they're quite prominent and have obviously contributed a lot to our understanding of politics, but because I think they both reflect actually some real important tendencies in the field. So Skocpol, of course, began not as a political scientist, but as a historical sociologist. She was a student of Barrington Moore. And that is very much the sort of tradition of political development that I count myself in. It is now a dead tradition in political science. Nobody really works like in that manner anymore. Although obviously when Skocpol wrote her dissertation, which turned into her great book, States and Social Revolutions, that was quite prominent in historical sociology, of what the particular field she came from, but also to a large degree in political science as well. And the idea behind that was not only that you had to understand political development over time, that is to say, sort of snapshot analyses of whatever, a revolution, looking at it just from its sort of beginning to its end of democratization, looking at the period preceding and then right after democratization to try to understand what was going on, that was going to give you very warped views of both the causes of particular events, revolutions, democratization, as well as their consequences down the road. And so these kind of long historical sweeps of different critical events in political history, that was really quite common back then. It's really not something that we do as political scientists anymore. There has been a shift as a sort of reaction to the incredibly thin analyses that a lot of folks were putting forward as far as kind of formal modeling and some quantitative work to layer on to those, sort of case studies. And while there are indeed some people who have done decent examples of that, in general, I think for anyone who is historically or qualitatively minded, the case studies that, students and some faculty members do these days as a way to kind of add flesh to their experiments or models or whatever are really, really very thin. They are not stand-alone treatments of events, but rather ways for them to illustrate arguments that they have already, sort of made in their own minds. So Skocpol is a kind of exemplar back then of a political development approach. She's moved on to focus obviously much more on American politics these days, so she's doing slightly different work. But that tradition that her great book, States and Social Revolutions, came out of, her later work on bringing the state back in, that's the kind of tradition that this book works in. And Fukuyama, who obviously also works in that tradition, isn't in a political science department, right? I mean, despite the fact that he's written many books and articles that have spurred, many, many conversations and shifted our agendas in many ways, he's not in a political science department and probably couldn't get a job in a mainstream one today because of the work that he does. So, I think this is, again, a book that draws on a tradition that was more prominent in the past, and I think should be more prominent going forward, but is not something that, you know, comparativists and other political scientists do to a large degree today.
Yeah, well, thank you for carrying on this tradition, because I quite enjoy the qualitative social science. I learned quite a bit from it, whereas the quantitative, it's a part of my training. I just don't get as much out of it. So I appreciate that. So let's get into the argument of the book. So the book sets out to understand how democracies and dictatorships developed, by seeing how they developed in the past, particularly in Europe, which as you say, it takes a sort of broad historical sweep, which avoids the tendency towards a sort of snapshot approach of social science, which is great. I thought maybe we could start by just talking briefly about the main concepts of the book, which you talk about in the first chapter about dictatorship and democracy, in part because democracy is a, you know, famously contested term, and you have a couple different meanings of it that you discuss, more of a minimal type of understanding of democracy and more consolidated or liberal form of democracy. So maybe you could start out by just sort of sketching what you mean by these terms.
Well, there are obviously different types of democracy. And one of the interesting things is that over the last years, with the rise of populism and some democratic backsliding in parts of the world, people have once again kind of returned to analyzing, you know, what the differences between electoral democracy and liberal democracy are, right? Because for much of the post-war period in the West, we kind of just assumed that liberal democracy was kind of a thing, right? That these naturally went together. But one of the things we're realizing now is that, in fact, they do not naturally go together at all. And one of the things that I stress in my book is, again, how historically myopic we have been. Before 1945, liberal democracy was not the norm anywhere. It's only really a product of the post-war period. There were many democratic experiments in Europe before 1945, but pretty much none of them were actually liberal democracy. They were what we might consider today to be electoral democracy or illiberal democracy. And what that means is there were elections. You know, democracy is can be conceptualized as a particular way in which people choose their rulers, right, as opposed to, you know, hereditary, divine right, chosen by an oligarchy or an elite. But they were not liberal in the sense that they were not able or willing to ensure individual and minority rights, guarantee the rule of law, all of those kinds of things that we associate with the liberal part of liberal democracy. Those two parts, the liberal part and the democratic part, really only came together in any kind of sustained fashion after 1945. And so what we're seeing today, again, is them separating, right? Not only in places where there's been some very significant democratic backsliding, Turkey, Hungary, Poland, places where there are still elections, leaders feel like they have to hold them to have some legitimacy, but where the other parts of liberal democracy, again, rule of law, protection for individual and minority rights, those things have been significantly pared away. So while it might on some level be legitimate to call these things flawed democracies or electoral democracies or illiberal democracies, they are not liberal democracies. And in the West, the rise of populism has also brought this question back to the forefront because, you know, parties in the West, populist parties in Western Europe, Donald Trump in the United States, they very much claim to be Democrats. You know, they don't question the legitimacy of elections in the sense of needing to have them. They may question the legitimacy of the outcomes, but they don't, as their counterparts in the past during the interwar period or the 19th century would have rejected the idea of elections overall. And in fact, they also claim that part of the problem today is that democracy is not very democratic, that the will of the people has been thwarted by elites or whoever. So they claim to be Democrats, in fact, better Democrats than their opponents, but they're not, again, clearly liberal or pluralist. That is to say, they very much question some of the liberal norms and procedures that we've come to associate with democracy. So again, I think, you know, current trends have forced us to recognize that liberal democracy is a type of political regime, but there are other types of political regimes as well, not just authoritarian, but also illiberal democracy or electoral democracy. That is to say, much thinner forms of democracy than the liberal form that we kind of thought was the norm in the West, but in fact, again, as a historical perspective brings out, is very much not the norm.
Yeah, and you emphasize how actually rare and late the development of liberal democracy comes. I mean, just a little bit more on liberal democracy. I mean, you sort of have emphasized the ways in which current trends, the liberal element of democracy falls away. I wonder, you also, I think, talk about this a little bit in the conclusion, but the ways in which the democratic element may fall away and the liberal one becomes paramount. That is, that I mean, the sort of rise of neoliberalism in the 70s, 80s in Europe, is that a useful way to conceptualize? I mean, is that a sort of, as it were, a third type of democracy, that one that has too much liberalism and not enough democracy? Or
right. So that's a great question. I mean, again, I think what we're doing now is we're seeing that there's lots more variations or combinations than we thought during the post-war period. So, you know, if the one type of variation that everybody's talking about today because of populism is kind of illiberal democracy, that is to say democracy without all the liberal norms and procedures, the other equally prevalent one, and I would say that they feed off each other, are causally related, is what I and others have referred to as kind of undemocratic liberalism. Right, which is to say that, you know, you can think of this in an economic sense or a political sense, right? The one you mentioned, I think, was primarily the kind of economic sense, which is the idea that we have liberalized, neoliberalized, whatever, our economy to the point where we are threatening democracy in some fundamental ways, taking powers away from governments, hurting citizens economically, increasing social cleavages in society, yada, yada, yada. But the other way to think about it, right, is, that while the sort of populists, right, push back against liberalism in order to protect, in their view, democracy, there are a lot of people who, in reaction, and again, for political theorists, this will be a sort of familiar dynamic, in reaction to what they see as the kind of irrationalism of the masses or the dangers of majoritarianism, are very interested in limiting democracy as much as possible. I mean, this is a long-standing critique by certain strands of liberals, more even prominently libertarians and others, about democracy, right? Which is that the masses can't be trusted, majoritarianism is dangerous, and so we should put as many limits on rule by the majority as possible. I mean, one argument that the book makes and others have made, I think Bill Galston, who you had on, also has talked about this, is that too much limiting of democracy, too much distance between politicians, parties, governments, and the people is very likely to contribute to the kind of populist backlash that we've seen today, right? Which is to say that the more people feel like government and parties and politicians are not responsive to them, that more and more areas of decision-making have been taking out of the hands of national governments and being passed on to whatever, technocrats, international organizations, the European Union, markets, whatever, the angrier they're going to get and the more, again, likely they are to vote for populists who promise to return power to national governments to protect national sovereignty, yada, yada, yada. And you could very much see this even on parts of the left after the election to Trump, this kind of hysterical belief that, again, the masses couldn't be trusted. And, you know, it would just be so much better if we insulated parties and politicians and policymaking from these crazy people more generally. This is a very old critique. It is a very dangerous critique, I think. And again, I think this kind of undemocratic liberalism and illiberal democracy have a tendency to feed off each other. They're equally pernicious and they make things worse.
Yeah, I mean, it's in a way no wonder that liberal democracy is so hard to achieve, because you have these two things, liberalism and democracy, that taken in their pure forms are destructive, and they're in some ways in tension with one another. So it's sort of hard to put them together into a kind of golden mean.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. I mean, and again, yeah. One of the things that I spend a lot of time talking about in the book is, again, as we've mentioned several times, how rare that combination actually is. Again, only really dominant after 1945. And as you mentioned, part of the reason for this is that A, liberalism is actually much harder to achieve than democracy. It requires much more of citizens and societies. And B, they are kind of in tension, right? Because liberalism is all about, in some way, limiting rule of the people, placing limits on what the people or majorities can do. And so, you know, getting that to kind of work, you know, and getting people to accept that is legitimate and necessary, that's really, again, historically has been very difficult to do.
Yeah, good. Another sort of high altitude feature of the book is, say, part of the argument of the book is the good attention I think you pay to the not just the political development, but also the ways in which sort of the economic and social institutions of any one regime sort of interact with the political development. So it takes much longer. I mean, one of the reasons why it's so difficult to achieve democracy is that it's not just enough to topple the political institutions, that those political institutions have sort of entangled themselves in the economic and social forces of society that makes it more difficult to sort of cast off the old dictatorship to move to democracy. You want to say any more about that, or any good examples on that front?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. One of the other things that an examination of European history throws up is, another illustration of why it's so important to take this kind of long-term, deep political development perspective, is that dictatorships are not merely political regimes in the sense that they're more than just, again, a type of way of choosing your leaders, a certain set of political institutions, yada, yada. They tend to have very deep impacts on the nature of a country's society and economy. And so, you know, when you make a transition from dictatorship to democracy, simply changing the political institutions and procedures is the first, and in some ways, ironically, the easiest step in actually attempting to build a democracy. Because if you don't come to grips with the social and economic legacies of undemocratic regimes, those democratic procedures and institutions are not going to function well. So what does that mean sort of concretely? So, you know, if you were to look, for instance, at, you know, the great period of democratic breakdown in Europe during the interwar period, right? So after 1918, you kind of have this critical juncture because monarchical dictatorships disappear as a kind of political alternative from Europe, right? Up until then, they had been kind of more or less the standard fallback position. After 1918, you no longer have monarchical dictatorships as a political alternative. There are still some monarchies that remain, but they're not ruling monarchies. They're symbolic, right? So you have that gone, right? And all countries after 1918 essentially make a transition to democracy. But what happens is, in a lot of those countries that make transitions, very powerful legacies from those previous dictatorships remain. What does that mean? You still have very entrenched economic and political elites. You have extremely divided societies, sometimes communally, ethnically, religiously, because dictatorships rule best by divide and rule, by separating citizens, by class, by ethnicity, by religion, by language. And so what you had in 1918, again, or rather after the First World War, was this massive democratic wave, a formation of new countries, transitions to democracy across the continent, but the deep legacies of these long-standing dictatorships remained in the economy and in society and made it very difficult for those new democratic institutions and procedures to function. I mean, one of the stories that the book tells, one of the things that European history teaches, is that it really took an incredible amount of violence, an incredible amount of time to eradicate a lot of those social and economic legacies. It only happens in Western Europe after the terrible violence and tragedy of fascism, National Socialism, and the Second World War. But again, when you layer on democratic procedures and institutions, political institutions and procedures, onto societies and economies with deeply undemocratic structures and features, you do not get well-functioning democracy. You get electoral democracy, maybe illiberal democracy, and more often eventual democratic collapse. And that's really a lot of the story that European history tells, right? Again, this very, very gradual process, very, very difficult process of eradicating undemocratic social and economic legacies, even, again, in the midst of, after 1789, the French Revolution, many attempts at democratization. But they all, almost all fail, again, because you're trying to layer political institutions, democratic political institutions, onto undemocratic, again, to use a simplistic term, societies and economies. And that combination does not produce stable, well-functioning democracy.
What tends to democratize for, well, the political institutions tend to democratize first, and then the economic or the social parts of society tend to democratize?
Well, that's, again, that's a great question. I mean, if you look at European history, as I said, okay, so you've got lots of examples of attempts at democratization from 1789 starting, but very few, if any, examples of stable liberal democracy before, again, the post-war period. So what you see if you look at the case studies in the book or were to examine European history on your own, right, is a very gradual process starting in Europe with the French Revolution of eradicating the undemocratic legacies of dictatorships. Most people know the story of the French Revolution, so they know this, but they perhaps don't think about it that way. What does the French Revolution do, right? It begins to eradicate the social and economic infrastructure of the Ancien Regime. What does that mean? It means no more legal hierarchies in society. Everybody is a citizen. Everybody has equal access to the rule of law. People are treated as individuals. They're not treated as members of a particular, you know, essentially a caste or an estate in the European parlance. You have a transition to a new type of economy, one that is much more capitalistic rather than one where resources are based on, again, what caste or estate you're a member of. And so all of these things begin to change in France and then later on with the French Revolution. But they happen very slowly, right? They happen very, very slowly. It takes all the way up through, as I said, you know, sort of the 20th century until all of those anti-democratic or if you want to call them pre-modern legacies of the Ancien Regime are eliminated. And that's why, again, when you have subsequent attempts at democratization, 1848 in France, other parts of the 1848 across Europe, other parts of Europe throughout the late 19th and early 20th century, they don't succeed because, again, these anti-democratic legacies from the old regime still remain.
Yeah, that's great. So I thought we could talk about France and England and Germany, which are really maybe the three main cases that you talk about in the book. There's so much wealth of detail in this. I'm certain we will not get through all of it or even most of it. But in the case of France, you just brought it up. I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about France's history because this is France is particular, maybe out of all the cases, the one that best illustrates your point that it takes a really long time and it involves a lot of backsliding and violence. France went through so many different governments and so many different republics and backslid into monarchy and so forth over the 19th and 20th centuries that it's hard to keep track of them all the time. Maybe you could say a little bit about France's development. It had a very strong centralized state that came out of the Ancien Regime, particularly from Louis the 14th. So what accounted for its great, you know, oscillation of different regimes? What made it so difficult? You could say this sort of build on your discussion of the French Revolution and move forward.
So, so in many ways, sort of France is kind of, I don't know, there's so many key crucial cases, but, you know, France is the home of the French Revolution, which is in many ways the legitimate starting point of the struggle for modern democracy, not just in Europe, but in the world more generally, right? So what does the French Revolution do, right? It sort of is an attack, not just upon the Ancien Regime as a type of rule, that is to say a form of dictatorship, but again, on the sort of social and economic underpinnings of that regime, right? A society that was organized horizontally, right, where people's life chances, the type of laws they were subject to, the type of punishments they got, the type of taxes or lack of taxes they paid, everything about their life was largely determined by the caste or estate that they had been born into. And similarly, you did not have a capitalist economy. The resources that you got, your ability to you know, kind of make money, own property, again, the kind of taxes you paid, all of that was not determined by the market, but rather by, again, your position in society. And the French Revolution is really the first attempt to form a democratic regime, but it's also, again, the first attempt to begin eradicating all of those other social and economic legacies of the Ancien Regime. But what do we know that happens, right? The French Revolution happens, right? You have this incredible idealism. If you go back to the time, as political theorists, I'm sure, are very aware, everybody thought this was the dawn of a new era. Europe was going to finally be transformed into this, you know, sort of shiny, happy place of, you know, sort of citizens. And what do we get? I mean, we get the collapse of that first democratic experiment, not just quickly, but into what many people consider to be the first totalitarian regime of the modern era, that is to say the reign of terror, right? So, you know, France goes through in the period between 1789 and 1799, incredible violence, incredible turmoil, innumerable types of political shifts, until finally Napoleon comes in and kind of brings some stability to the whole, to the country. And he does that, interestingly enough, by initiating what would become yet another new type of political regime, one that would have remarkable staying power, which is essentially a populist authoritarian dictatorship. I mean, what's one of the many, many things that's so interesting about Napoleon, right, is he does eventually become a dictator, but he's an entirely different type of dictator than his predecessors, you know, the kings were. He claims to be ruling in the name of the people. He claims to have popular legitimacy, and he does do things like, again, you know, sort of have referenda that are supposed to kind of illustrate his support for the people. And he himself, of course, is a figure of somewhat modest background. He saw himself as a product of the revolution, and he saw himself as protecting and furthering many of the revolution's gains. But, you know, again, we have 10 years of swinging back and forth before France settles into this populist dictatorship. That, of course, we also know collapses then back into another type of monarchical dictatorship, although one that is also quite different from its Ancien Regime predecessors. And then France continues up through the 20th century to go back and forth, swing back and forth between many different types of political regimes. There's a funny quip that I include in the book about France by the late 19th century having gone through so many political transitions that a joke had it that the National Library kept its copies of the Constitution in the periodical section, right? and that's, you know, it's funny, but it's illustrative of how politically unstable, you know, France was. I mean, right now, France is living in a fifth republic, which at the very least indicates that there were five attempts to form a stable democracy. And in fact, that actually hides a lot more political instability than that, because there were lots of transitions that happened that are not, you know, sort of, that are transitions within different, you know, broader categories. And yet this is the home of the French Revolution. This is the place where democracy's first modern experiment occurred. And so if it takes France, you know, starting in 1789, over 150 years until it gets to the Fifth Republic, you know, then that says something about how difficult it is actually for stable liberal democracy to be achieved.
Yeah, I wonder what you think of Tocqueville's Ancien Regime and the Revolution, his analysis there of the, his analysis is that, if I recall this correctly, that, you know, France was, as it moved into the revolution, was too centralized. It was too homogenous. The state was too strong. And so when the monarch was toppled, then civil society itself wasn't left to sort of work on its own. So it had to sort of develop its own centralized power. So in other words, there's in the too centralized powerful state, when you get rid of the head, you're left with a vacuum. And so that vacuum is replaced by another powerful centralized head. And you have Napoleon and so forth. What do you make of that? I mean, so Tocqueville sort of, I think, places a lot of the explanation of France's woes at the strength of power of a centralized state.
So I have to say that going back through all of this incredible literature on European political development was daunting, but there were some people who came out sort of ahead, so to speak, and Tocqueville is definitely one of them. I mean, it won't surprise political theorists and certainly other political scientists to know that he was a very smart and observant guy. And so, it's a trivial thing to say, but it's nice to kind of go back and see it with fresh eyes. So he said a couple of very, very, very important things about the French Revolution, which I think cannot be overstressed. The centralization of the French state, it's important to just remember, was a reaction to the incredible fragmentation and chaos that France underwent during the 16th and 17th century. So the centralization under, Louis XIV in particular, was a reaction to the fact that the country seemed to be on the verge of disintegration. And so that's very, very important to remember. But to get back, he says two things which you mentioned that I think are very important, which is one about how the sort of this centralization that happens under Louis XIII, Louis XIV, and to a lesser degree their successors, what that does, again, and this is another important reflection of how crucial it is to take this long-term perspective, right? That the dictatorship, if you want to think about it that way, because that's what it really did was it robbed society, not just obviously of civil society, but of any other kinds of political institutions capable of being the sort of foundation for collective action, right? So the obvious one, even some of my students kind of know, is that the Estates General sort of stops being called in the early 17th century. There's no national forum for people, even elites, to kind of get together and sort of discuss politics, pass information on to the king, for the king to kind of gain consensus in society, yada, yada, yada. So what happens, again, thinking from a political development perspective, when a very centralized dictatorship explodes, leaving behind absolutely no institutions, either at the political level or the civil society level, for citizens to act collectively? Well, it's chaos, right? And so that's what happens, right? When the monarchy disappears, right, when the king gets his head chopped off, there's just nothing left there, right? And so, even after the Estates General is called 1788, 1789, it can't function very well because, having not been called since the early 17th century, they end up spending half their time fighting about how it should actually even constitute itself, right? So there's no body there, as there was in England, for example, with the Parliament, to provide a forum within which different groups could get together, could forge compromises, discuss what the future should look like, yada, yada, yada. So when you have an incredibly centralized dictatorship, Ancien Regime France, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and it collapses, having suppressed any other forms of political or civil society organization, are you surprised that there's chaos? You shouldn't be, because there's nothing else left there to fill in that vacuum. The other thing related to that Tocqueville very much stresses is that, again, the dictatorship ruled basically by creating deep, deep divisions in French society, right? Again, another reason why it's so important to know how dictatorships develop if you want to understand what's going to happen to the democracies that follow them, right? Created incredibly deep divisions in French society, particularly between the first and second and the third estates, right? People had come to see the nobility in particular as parasites, as wastrels. They no longer performed any functions. They just sat around and sucked money out of the peasantry and the poor. And so again, when the lid is taken off the pot, there's this incredible resentment that explodes and, again, feeds into the revolution. So I think Tocqueville's analysis of Ancien Régime France still, again, has a lot to offer us about understanding why and how the revolution happened, but also more generally in reminding us that if we don't understand the nature of dictatorships, we can't possibly understand what happens in the period after their collapse.
Yeah, so I thought we could contrast France with Germany, which had a different experience coming out of the Ancien Régime. Germany, contrast to France, very, very weak state. I mean, before we get to Prussia, but a very disaggregated political system. I mean, there wasn't even really a Germany until well into the 19th century. And so it was a, something of a kind of plaything of the stronger European powers. So maybe you could take us through a little some of the highlights when it comes to Germany. How is it that Germany sort of diverged from the French model, and what can we learn from it?
So one of the things that I spend a lot of time talking about in the book is how much the way the state is formed influences subsequent political development. So we talked about that just right now with the French case, right? It's hard to understand the French Revolution and subsequent French political development if you don't understand how the Ancien Régime state was built. The same is 100% true in all European countries, and you can see that very clearly in the German case. So, I mean, as you mentioned, up through the early modern period there, obviously, there's no Germany, and Prussia itself is a kind of product of that period in the sense that it's during that same time that Prussia becomes this incredibly centralized, militarized state, right? Before that, it had been a kind of collection of, you know, different provinces, not even geographically connected, not particularly powerful, but under, again, as in France, a series of pretty remarkable monarchs, the Hohenzollerns, you get this incredible centralization in Prussia and this incredibly powerful state, the kind of, again, another good quip that's often used today, but was originally referring to Prussia is, you know, what you have is an army with a state rather than a state with an army, right? And so the way Prussia is built, right, is by taking the nobility, and rather than, as in France, expunging them of their political power, right? That's what the monarchs, the Louis, do in France. They take away the nobility's political power, but in return give them a whole variety of social and economic goodies. In Prussia, what the monarchs do is they basically integrate the nobility into the state, by giving them high positions in the civil service, in the army, and by allowing them to retain political power at the local but not at the national level. And so that's the Prussia that comes up through the modern period, that becomes a sort of European great power, and that is the foundation of the modern German state, right? So Germany's formed in the late 19th century after Prussia wins a series of wars against its European opponents, France and Austria, most importantly, and it forms on the basis of its own interests the modern German state. Well, what does that mean? It means that Bismarck and the new German state are designed partially to protect the power of Prussia and the power of the Prussian nobility. So what that means is you get a political system that obviously turns the Prussian king into the German emperor, that makes Prussia by far, I mean, it just is the most powerful state in Germany. It's two-thirds of the new German Reich. Its power to basically veto and set the agenda is established within the new Germany by giving it essentially, again, veto power in the upper house of the new German parliament. And you don't get full parliamentarization in Germany either. So basically you have this kind of weird system in the German Reich where you have universal manhood suffrage, which, by the way, is, again, extremely unusual in Europe at the time. The only other major country that has that is the Third Republic in France. But you don't have a parliamentary system. That is to say that the executive, the prime minister, is not dependent on the support of a majority in parliament to stay in power, and that prime minister is appointed by the king, who, of course, is only going to appoint conservatives, Bismarck being, of course, the first prime minister of the unified Germany. So you have to understand something about the Prussian state and about Prussian history in order to understand why Germany was formed the way it was and why its new political system looks the way it does. And this political system, again, is a weird mishmash, although it's not entirely different from some kinds of systems we see today, right? Which is, it's not a traditional dictatorship in the sense that, again, there is a parliament, and there is universal manhood suffrage, but it's neither a fully democratic nor a fully parliamentary system, as I said, because those votes don't determine the government, and the prime minister doesn't stay in power because he has a majority in parliament. However, he cannot pass legislation without the support of a majority in parliament. So he can stay in power, the government is there, but it needs to get the support of a majority to pass legislation. And what happens over time in Germany is this creates obviously a lot of tension. And what happens is by the time of the First World War, governments are unable actually to pass significant legislation because the modernization of German society creates increasing demands for policies that conservatives don't like and for more influence for the lower and middle classes. And so by the time of the First World War, Germany is really politically, domestically, quite a mess. There's an incredible frustration in society with the government. There's an incredible rise of nationalistic organizations upset with the government. And there's a government that feels increasingly beleaguered because it can't pass the policies that it wants to pass. And there is a tradition in German history, therefore, that sees the headlong rush into the First World War as a sort of endogenous event, right? A desire on the part of elites, either consciously or unconsciously, to kind of jump into war as a way to avoid what is clearly a coming, sort of domestic showdown, a way to kind of paper over the divisions in German society that had by that point become, seemingly irreconcilable. So, the First World War is, the backstory to that also has to be seen as much in the domestic as it is in the international sphere.
Right. It's often struck me in the 19th century, Germany, especially Prussia, looks to war in order to unify what would otherwise be very divergent kinds of interests, and nationalism, of course, which both of those are interrelated in order to unify the country. I thought on that latter concept, on nationalism, you have a lot to say about nationalism. I thought maybe you could sort of take us through this sort of development of nationalism, because one of the weird things about nationalism is sort of starts in a Republican way. I mean, of course, this is sort of, according to many, born in the French Revolution, as connected to the idea of popular sovereignty and the development of a notion of a people. But then it becomes much more, turns from a kind of Republican notion of nationalism and later into the 19th century into much more of an ethnic notion of nationalism, much nastier form of nationalism, as we know that. And we know they all know the history after that. So what leads nationalism in that direction?
Mm-hmm. So that's a great question. I mean, and again, one of the nice things that European history does is remind us that nationalism can be a force for progress and it can be a force for reaction. So, I mean, as you said, during the late 18th and first half of the 19th century, it is a progressive force, right? It is the force that unifies people against the Ancien regime, against monarchs. Monarchs don't rule in the name of the people. They don't feel that they owe their people anything. They rule because they're monarchs by divine right or hereditary or whatever. And, so particularly after the French Revolution, nationalism is this incredibly progressive force that says, no, the people are sovereign. Governments should reflect the will of the people, not the will of some, again, hereditary monarch or some out-of-touch elite. And so up through the early 19th, or the mid-19th century, nationalism is a force for progress. It's a force allied with democracy and liberalism and against the Ancien regime. And it's also important to note that even after that, up through the 20th century, nationalism is a force that helps to give us, again, not just democracy, but also, as I talk about in my book, Welfare States, right? This idea that it's the job of the government to protect the people, to provide the people with what they need. This is an incredibly powerful progressive force. But obviously, European history also gives us a lot of examples of nationalism acting as a reactionary force. This becomes more prominent in Europe in the second half of the 19th century, and obviously during the early parts of the 20th century, when nationalism begins to see in democracy and in liberalism its enemies, and of course in socialism, which is seen as a kind of international force arrayed against the people, the national people, and liberalism as a force, again, breaking down the kind of solidaristic ties, the social norms, the social traditions that define nations and, make them distinctive. So as democracy, liberalism, and socialism become more prominent in Europe in the late 19th and early 20th century, nationalism begins to kind of, so to speak, turn inward and become more reactionary. This is also a consequence of the fact that the late 19th and early 20th century is a period of great state formation. We talked about Germany, for instance. Italy, of course, is also becomes a unified country in the late in the 1860s. After the First World War, of course, with the collapse of empires, we get a whole bunch of new countries in Eastern Europe. And these are the countries, right, where national identities are weak, where national traditions are obviously first being built, where nationalism takes on its most virulent forms. That is to say, you know, it's again a kind of reaction to the fact that nation building hasn't really started yet. And so nationalism becomes this kind of force that's used by, used by is maybe the wrong term, that becomes a sort of instrument for bringing together people within a new Italy, within a new Germany, within all of these new nations of Eastern Europe, and, you know, sort of gives them some sense of kind of unity. And by definition, the easiest way to kind of do that is by, you know, sort of turning against the other, by saying, look, we are German, you know, our enemies are X, or we are Polish and all of these other people in Poland are not, or we are Italian and, you know, all of these other things are not. So, you know, nationalism again turns into this kind of force to divide people rather than as this force fighting for progressive goals like, again, democracy and later the welfare state during the late 19th and early 20th century. So you see both sides or both faces of nationalism in European history.
Yeah, I wonder what you think about the necessity of the turn from a kind of liberal or Republican nationalism to an ethnic nationalism. I mean, this is one debate in political theory is whether liberal states should embrace nationalism or not. And in part, I think a lot of these debates turn on an empirical question as to whether nationalism does turn kind of nasty. Yeah. I just described it or not, or, you know, is it like, to change metaphors, or is it a kind of dynamite that maybe we just shouldn't appeal to, or is it something that can be properly contained and can be used for liberal Republican ends?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, obviously, again, it's interesting how these debates, you know, sort of come back over and over again. From a historical perspective, as well as from today, the only context within which you've gotten democracy, citizenship by definition, and welfare states are nation states. That is the empirical reality. So insofar as you favor democracy, you favor welfare states and all the privileges that go with citizenship, then you have to understand that there is some role for nationalism in the form of a sort of sense of fellow feeling, a sense of solidarity, a sense that there's something, again, that distinguishes your nation from others. Not necessarily better or worse, just different, because this is the political context within which all of the great things, political rights, social rights, welfare state rights, occur. I think that there is a very fine line, and we've seen history swing back and forth between, you know, as we just discussed, progressive and reactionary forms of nationalism. But, you know, as long as we live in a world, which we have since the beginning of the modern era with the French Revolution, and we still do today, where, again, all of the things that we in the West have come to take for granted and would love to see other people enjoy as well. Again, democracy, welfare states, citizenship rights, these are things that come within the context of nation states. And so that is the reality. And so some form of nationalism probably has to go along with that. Otherwise, it seems very hard for me to understand why people would continue to contribute to and willingly be a part of these countries if they don't feel some kind of special kinship with them and the other people who live within those borders. But yes, I mean, it doesn't take very much for these things to shift from, I feel a strong attachment to people in my whatever country, to I feel really negatively about people everywhere else. Those two things do not have to be the same thing. But unfortunately, and sometimes they, you can slip more from one into the other. And that is surely something that history teaches us we have to be very careful about. But nationalism, it seems hard for me to understand how you would get rid of that if you're living in a world where nation states remain the home of, again, all of the things that we in the West don't want to live without and presumably would like to see other people enjoy as well.
Yeah, that seems right to me. I mean, this fits into your broader, I think, thesis that it's not enough to just tear down the ancien regime. One of the things that developing democracies need to do is create new modes and orders to replace them. And in part, that requires sort of setting up forms of community that will sort of maintain the loyalty of the people and give them a sense of meaning and purpose in the world. And nationalism, of course, is one way in which historically that's happened. The other way is, of course, you know, socialism or communism. And I thought we could talk briefly about its role in the development of democracy in Europe. Of course, it has a massively important role to play. I wonder if you'd say, you know, broadly, how, you know, in what ways socialism sort of intersected with the development of liberal democracy, what ways it sort of interrupted it, or what ways it sort of advanced it. I mean, do you think socialism on the whole was productive of democratic development, or sort of arrested it?
So I love talking about socialism as if anybody who listens to this knows anything about my previous work. So look, socialism is a very, very broad tent label in European history. It is important to remember that even though, you know, we sort of get an international socialist movement by the late 19th century in Europe, that this movement quickly fragments into several different currents, some of which remain important pro-democratic forces, others of which do not. So it is important if we want to start in 1848. This is when Europe experiences both a democratic wave and, of course, the Communist Manifesto is printed. That pressure from below, largely but not exclusively in the form of growing workers' movements, is an incredibly powerful force pushing democracy forward. In the sense that really it's the working class that's pushing for political opening much more so than any other class. So as we mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, liberals in the form of both liberal individuals and liberal parties up through the early 20th century are very wary about full democratization. They too want to be able to participate in politics, so they favor some expansion of the suffrage, and they favor obviously an expansion of liberal rights, but they are not on their own interested at all in universal suffrage, because they understand that what that means is giving, again, power to the workers and the poor, and they very much do not want to do that. So it is empirically incorrect to see liberals and liberal parties as the primary force pushing for universal suffrage in particular. I sort of mentioned in the book, there's this great quote by Barrington Moore, no bourgeoisie, no democracy. I think historically the better way of putting that would be no bourgeoisie, no liberalism, right? Because it is not clear, there are very few examples, again, it is not the norm for liberals or liberal parties to push for full democratization. What they really want, again, is liberalism and enough expansion of political participation to include them. Their preferred option would be, again, to keep the working class out, which is why, for instance, they favored things like property restrictions, educational restrictions, multiple voting, yada, yada, yada. So from an empirical perspective, it's very important to recognize how significant pressure from below was in expanding the suffrage, and how much liberals, forget about conservatives, obviously, who were never really all that interested in democratization for the most part, how hesitant liberals were to go full-fledged into a complete democratic system, and how, again, without pressure, they would not have done so. Now, to get back, though, to your original question about the role of socialism, look, you know, by the early 20th century, and again with the Russian Revolution in particular, we have a very fragmented socialist movement. And, you know, communists are not interested in democracy at all. They play an actively anti-democratic role, obviously, after the Russian Revolution. Not only, obviously, is Russia not a democracy, but communist parties in Europe in the interwar period, actively aided by the Soviet Union, do everything they can to thwart democratic experiments, engaging in violence, insurrections, and, again, most infamously in Germany, joining with the Nazis to vote against democratic governments at the end of the Weimar Republic. So, you know, communism actively anti-democratic and has to be considered a significant although clearly not the most important factor in the demise of democracy in Europe during the interwar period. The most consistently democratic force in Europe in the late 19th and early 20th century is what I would call sort of social democrats, that is to say people who come from the socialist movement, the international socialist movement, but who gave up the idea that, you know, the path to a better future lies through revolution or the collapse of capitalism. You know, they retain the ideals of socialism, the desire to create a better world, a more just world, you know, a more equal world, but they turn their backs on the kind of, again, catastrophism and revolutionism inherent in Marxism and later communism. These are the people who most consistently push for democracy and who play a very important role, not just during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, but obviously in the post-war period in giving us a lot of the things we like about democracy, welfare states, they're obviously crucial, and also obviously forming the foundation of many governments during the post-war period.
The third, I thought we could just shift to the third case quickly that I mentioned we could talk about, which is England, because mm-hmm. England is unlike the others. If you say they're English exceptionalism in right. the sense that England doesn't seem to go through the same kind of internal struggle and long train of wars and bloodshed in order to democratize. So what accounts for this sort of English exception?
Mm-hmm. So when I looked back at Europe comparatively, I actually found the English case to be the most puzzling in the sense of being the most exceptional, as you said. Oftentimes, again, I spent a lot of time thinking about Germany in the past, and Germany is often, you know, sort of portrayed as the kind of outlier, the sort of the sort of exceptional case. And I actually did not see it that way going back now in a very deeply comparative sense. It's the English case that is the most unusual. The German case strikes me, again, in a deep comparative perspective as being at an extreme end of a sort of larger European continuum. So what's so weird or exceptional about the English case? Well, England goes through its period of political upheavals very early on, the 17th century, that is to say way before the French Revolution, when it goes through a period of civil wars and political chaos, ultimately kind of culminating in the Glorious Revolution. And why is that important? Well, it's important because at the end of the Glorious Revolution, obviously what England has that no other European country has is a balanced and constitutional system, a system where the parliament is able to keep the king in check and eventually even grow in importance, and a constitution that sets out some clear, sort of liberal rights, norms, you know, for English and to some degree British society going forward. And that this happens before the turmoil of the French Revolution, before the turmoil of capitalism, is incredibly important because Britain then has this parliament and has this series of norms and institutions that it can then use to deal with the challenges of the modern era, again, in the form of changing political and economic dynamics during the 18th, 19th, and 20th century. And so basically the story of Britain after the Glorious Revolution is a very odd one. What you have basically during the 18th and 19th century is the formation of what I think historically is the most powerful oligarchy that has ever existed. The amount of political, social, and economic power that the British elite keeps in its hands up until the 20th century is simply unmatched in any other society, certainly modern society that I could find. I mean, it would make, you know, sort of today's Koch brothers blush with envy. I mean, not only is the concentration of wealth and the concentration of land owning just far beyond what we see anyplace else in Europe, even places we think of as more unequal, like Russia or Germany, there's just no comparison. The amount of resources in the hands of the British landowning elite far surpasses that of their Russian or German counterparts. They also completely dominate all political institutions in Britain. Not just the House of Lords, but the Parliament, the civil service, the army, the church, everything. So the amount of social and economic and political power that British elite has, simply unmatched. But oddly, what happens is, unlike their counterparts in Germany or in Russia or in France that completely resist political change, during the 18th and 19th century, they very gradually and very grudgingly allow the system to be opened. And so what does this mean? You know, if you start modern political development in Britain, or if you date it from the Glorious Revolution, it takes up until 1918 till you get universal manhood suffrage. Let's forget about women, who don't count at all during this era. Now, that's a very, very long time, right, for a full democracy to occur. And what happens during that time is, again, each time the British elite, so to speak, is forced to recognize that if they don't make some kind of small or, you know, some kind of shift, that the chances of revolution or some significant political and social chaos will occur, they move, right? They're willing to accept very gradual change. So we get very gradual expansion of the suffrage, 1832, 1867, late 19th century, and then again with basically full universal manhood suffrage in the, you know, after the First World War. You get a gradual expansion of liberal rights, a gradual expansion of rights for workers to do things like organize, a very gradual expansion of social policy during the 19th and early 20th century. Interestingly enough, partially under conservative auspices, which is just something that you would never see in other countries. And so what happens is, this British elite, again, very, very unusual in comparison to other European countries, very slowly and very gradually allows for, again, political and other kind of opening. And in retrospect, this turns out to have been a very smart strategy, because this elite in Britain holds on to its political, economic, and social power way longer than its counterparts do, who inevitably get swamped or get destroyed by revolutions in places, again, like France or Germany or Russia. So it turned out to have been a smart strategy, although one doesn't have to assume that they understood precisely, you know, what the implications of what they were doing. But this is what enables Britain to avoid the political, social turmoil that characterized much of the rest of Europe in the post-French Revolution period.
Yeah, I mean, how about this as a kind of summary? I'm not sure if this is right, but England is exceptional in the sense that liberalism came first there rather than democracy preceding liberalism. Not obviously in the full suite of liberal rights, but at least you have that emphasis on the rule of law, or the sort of constitutional order, as you say, and that's sort of set the rules of the game, so that you don't have a kind of oscillation or power grabbing that would characterize the class conflict on among the continental regimes. So it's actually liberal. I mean, one lesson I suppose from England is that, you know, liberalism coming first can afford maybe a smoother transition to democracy. Do you think that's fair? Or
so that is the sort of standard interpretation, and I'm not saying it's wrong, but I do think it hides some very important dynamics. I mean, the most significant of which I've mentioned, right, which is that, you know, you could call what you had in what Britain was after the Glorious Revolution a liberal regime. But I think it's very important to recognize that liberalism was not incompatible with, as I said, an unbelievable concentration in political, social, and economic power. And so, you know, that in and of itself was, really quite problematic. And as I said, it took up until the 20th century to begin to really change that. So liberal, yeah, but liberal meaning that compatible with, again, concentrations of wealth and power, unlike that you even saw in places like pre-revolutionary France, Russia, Germany before the Nazi period. So, I don't think that story is wrong, but I think that story masks a lot of very difficult things or very important things that were happening in Britain during the, you know, during the 18th and 19th century.
Yeah. Sorry. I mean, it could sort of be take on a kind of triumphalist form, an exceptionalism in the sense, the bad sense of exceptionalism, mm-hmm. Right? We're sort of better in the sense that we can transition because we have it figured out. I thought maybe we have a few minutes left. I thought we could conclude by I have a few general questions, which is one about the role of religion in democratic development. Because in some, the question about religion is something like similar to the question about nationalism, which is, was it useful or not to democratization? I mean, in some sense, religion shores up status quo. It shores up the ancien regime, of course, provides its ideological justification in large part. But it also, religion served as a kind of ideological justification for the natural rights tradition, of course, in many ways. And so sort of reaction against the ancien regime, and also a kind of bulwark against fascism and communism as we move into the 20th century. I mean, so how do you think about the role of religion in European democratic development as a kind of, as necessary or beneficial or pernicious to political development?
So that's a great question, and it's probably one that I should think more about. So I'll answer it in the only way that I can, which may be a little bit one-sided. So here goes. You know, one of the sort of standard and I think correct stories about European political development is the importance of the sort of church-state conflict. That is to say that the conflict between religious and secular authority, you know, being one of the driving forces of modern political development. And I think that is not just true, but I think can't be overemphasized. So religious authorities, the church, were crucial components of Europe's ancien regime in France and all of Europe. And, you know, fighting back against the political, social, and economic power of the church was an incredibly important part of what was going on in Europe in the 19th and up through the 20th century. It's important to remember that, you know, in places like Franco Spain, the church remains an incredibly important political force, you know, again, up through the 20th century. And so fighting back against that is one of the, you know, most important reasons for the, you know, sort of the rise of secular power. It's also indirectly, I think, an important contributor to the rise of liberalism in the sense that there's nothing like, you know, sort of endless conflict to make people realize that maybe, you know, sort of compromise and protecting, you know, as you said, individual rights is something worth doing because the alternative is, you know, that much worse. The book does spend a lot of time talking about, and I've spent a decent bit of time, again, thinking about how the conflict between emerging secular and then democratic authorities, the conflict between those things and religious authorities in the church shaped European political development. But the flip side of that is, you know, what positive role did these forces play? And I think they probably did in ways that I don't give full credence to. The most obvious of which, of course, is that during the post-war period, Christian democratic parties, that is to say parties whose original rationale was protecting the interests of religion and religious folks in European societies from overweening secular authority, that these parties end up playing obviously a crucial role in the stabilization of democracy in Europe after 1945. And, you know, I think that's something that probably I don't give or rather pay enough attention to, but it's certainly an important legacy, positive legacy of religion and church-state conflict that, you know, sort of continues to characterize European democracies up through the present day.
Yeah, I mean, I ask it in part because I, you know, I wanted to move in our last few minutes to thinking about the present day and the challenges to European democracy, because religion and certainly religious conflict is at the forefront of some of the worries, especially the immigration debates in France and Germany. And maybe we could talk generally about the lessons that you draw from the historical account that you give for contemporary European liberal democracy. Think about it in terms of, you know, if you were to advise, maybe you've done this, I don't know, maybe to advise European politicians on how, you know, diehard liberal Democrat, how to preserve, foster liberal democracy in Europe. What is it that we can learn from the book that could be useful moving forward?
So I think, again, the way to answer that question is by going back a little bit, since, again, I'm sort of pushing this political development perspective. You know, if we look back at the period after 1945, that is to say when the foundations of stable liberal democracy were built in Western Europe, again, for the first time in European history, what's remarkable is how much it took to actually make liberal democracy work in Western Europe after 1945. So in addition to all of those changes and trends that had happened during the pre-World War II period, after 1945, we get dramatic, one might even say revolutionary changes at the domestic, regional, and international level, right? At the international level, we get an entirely new relationship between the United States and Europe. We get a whole series of international economic and security institutions, again, designed to kind of secure democracy in Europe and tie Europe to the United States. At the regional level, of course, we get the beginnings of European integration, which was explicitly designed, again, to avoid conflicts like Europe experienced in the past and to provide, a foundation for the peace and prosperity that were the necessary prerequisites for stable liberal democracy. And, of course, at the domestic level, we got an entirely new relationship between states and markets, or states and capitalism, right? Governments very explicitly promised their citizens, even writing these things into their post-war constitutions, that they would protect them from the vicissitudes of capitalism, that Social Security was a right that that they all deserved, and that governments would, again, ensure that there was no economic and social chaos like there was during the Great Depression. All of these things were necessary, I argue, to make democracy work after 1945. And all of them began, obviously, to kind of decay, not completely fall apart, but decay by the end of the 20th century, and obviously even more during the beginning of the 21st, especially after the financial crisis. So I think it's very important, again, to think back on what it took to make democracy work after 1945 so that we can understand what it might take to kind of revitalize it today. Now, that's a kind of long-winded way of saying something that maybe not be very helpful because obviously we're not going back to 1945. But I think the broader lessons there are, again, that social and economic stability are absolutely necessary to make liberal democracy work. And so what does that mean? That means, again, ensuring people that the government is able and willing to not just avoid too great economic dislocations, but protect citizens from, the downsides of open markets, free trade, and things like that. When people feel like governments are not protecting them, when they feel left behind, when they feel a great sense of economic risk, they are very likely to look for scapegoats. They are much more prone to radicalism and extremism. These were things that the post-war architects of Europe were extremely aware of, looking back at the Great Depression, and determined to prevent. I think people forgot that by the end of the 20th century after so much stability and after the sort of triumphalism of the collapse of communism. I think it's very important, again, to remember that post-war planners in Europe also understood the particular problems, as we talked about before, of virulent nationalism and of ethnic conflict. Obviously, this was also something characteristic of European history, and that had exploded during the interwar period and, obviously the Second World War. And again, a lot of the things that they put in place after the Second World War, welfare states most notably, were designed to kind of enhance social solidarity, enhance a sense of kind of kinship among people to prevent not just social, not just communal conflict, but obviously also class conflict. And again, recognizing how fragile social stability was and how much it needed to be cultivated. And I think, again, what happened during the late 20th and early 20th century is that people forgot how fragile these things were, how much they needed to be cultivated, how much governments had to do to ensure that they remained in place. And so, again, I think we now recognize what happens when we allow these things to kind of get out of hand. And, if we want to go back and think about what it took to make democracy work in the past, we need to figure out ways, again, to get our societies and our economies more rebalanced, to not let anyone feel like their success, that somebody else's success is coming at their expense, either economically or socially, because those kinds of situations create zero-sum conflicts. They create politics in which compromise and bargaining are impossible, in which scapegoating becomes very easy, and in which democracy cannot function well.
Yeah, so are you more on the side of sort of liberal internationalism as a means to achieve those ends, or more on the side of a sort of responsible nationalism and bolstering up national sovereignty?
I don't think those things are in conflict. I think the genius of one of the geniuses of the post-war order, again, you know, there's one of the classic books on European integration is Alan Millward's The European Rescue of the Nation State. Why is it called The European Rescue of the Nation State? The idea was that Europe was not supposed to eviscerate nation states. It was supposed to provide a context within which they could flourish, where they could deal with challenges that they could not deal with on their own, but still be able to provide for their citizens and to, again, protect their own sovereignty to a large degree. I think that those two things have to go together. It's a false choice. We need to be able to cooperate better internationally. We need to be able to avoid conflicts. We need to be able to figure out ways to deal with international challenges. But we can't do that in such a way that, again, seems to threaten national sovereignty, because as we spoke about before, it still remains the case that nation states are the context within which democracy functions and within which social provision is given. And so that those capabilities can't be destroyed.
Our last question, are you an optimist or a pessimist about the future of Europe?
I don't know if I can answer that question because it sort of depends on the day. I'm an incredible optimist about the power of liberal democracy, about the belief that, particularly in its social democratic version, it is by far the best system for ensuring human happiness and freedom. And so that makes me optimistic because I do not see any of the other alternatives as even coming close to being able to offer people the kinds of freedom and the kinds of choices that you know it offers. But I'm worried that a lot of people, elites in particular, have forgotten you know how precious and how precarious that is, and are not willing to make the kinds of sacrifices and difficult choices that are going to be necessary to make it work. So I'm sometimes optimistic, sometimes pessimistic.
Well, on that note, thank
you. Wishy-washy answer.
No, that's I feel the same way. Some days I fret about the long-term viability of liberal democracy. Sometimes I'm optimistic. So we can be one and the same on that. But thank you. This was great, Cherry. I really appreciate the conversation. And so thanks for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you for asking me and for such great questions.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. And thanks to you for listening.